From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
For those who had doubts about the existence of a new Cold War coming into Tuesday, it was difficult by the end of the day to sustain them. Early in the day, it was announced that the Dutch foreign minister, Halbe Zijlstra, resigned after admitting that he lied about attending a meeting in 2006 at which he had said Russian President Vladimir Putin outlined a strategy of expansion to build a greater Russia. RT's Medina Kachanova has more.
The Dutch foreign minister was quite emotional when he announced his resignation. He was supported by the country's prime minister, who was also present during this announcement, and he also seemed quite moved by the situation. Now, what happened today is the result of a big scandal that erupted when it was revealed that the Dutch foreign minister lied back in 2016 about an event in his life. And at that time, when he described that event, that didn't raise that much of a lot of questions, as it happened when Russia was accused of all sorts of things. Moscow was accused of carrying out aggressive politics. So that lie fit quite well into that context. Now, back in 2016, the Dutch foreign minister said that he was present at a meeting with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, and he heard the president talking about unifying Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states, and Kazakhstan into one single country, creating a greater Russia.
In early 2006, I was at Vladimir Putin's countryside house. I stopped at the back of a room where a meeting was being held, but I could hear very well Vladimir Putin talking about a greater Russia. He said this included Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, and the Baltic states, and that Kazakhstan would also be nice to have.
Well, these were his words back in 2016. But then when he was confronted about that, he acknowledged that that was a lie, that he was not even in Russia in 2006. And he was only protecting a source of his, a person that was at that meeting. And now the minister said that his credibility had been damaged by the scandal to such an extent that his position had become untenable. Now, he described the recent events as the biggest mistake in his political career, adding that the country deserves a foreign minister who is beyond any doubt. Now, all that is taking place just one day before his official meeting with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. I was about to attend this meeting, as were many other journalists, and we had questions for him prepared, of course, concerning this particular situation. But now, it seems that the meeting is off the table, as it was officially declined by the Dutch side.
Meanwhile, in Washington, the three heads of the groups that have become known collectively as the intelligence community were testifying that Russia, in fact, did interfere in the 2016 election in the U.S. and planned to do so again in this year's midterms. And again, no evidence was offered, although some was referenced. That, however, is top secret. But the lack of evidence didn't stop New York Democratic Representative Gerald Nadler from not only stating that Russia interfered in last year's election as a fact, but terming it as an act of war.
This is as much an attack on the United States as if they were bombs and bullets. Mm-hmm. It's an attack on our essential governing structure.
One of Nadler's Democratic colleagues in the Senate, however, has some problems of his own. RT's Jacqueline Voga has more.
In case you haven't noticed, the Democratic Party is very worried about big bad Russia.
They found portals into our society.
The Kremlin clan.
Russia has harnessed the tremendous and, quite frankly, to me, frightening power of social media.
Truly troubling evidence of the scope and reach of Russia's interference in our last election.
And the top Democrat on the Senate's Russian investigation, Mark Warner, is no exception to the rule.
I'm concerned that the president still does not recognize the severity of the threat.
But apparently Warner does, and he will do anything necessary to battle Moscow's reach. Based on leaked text messages between the senator and a second party, it looks like when it comes to the Russian threat, the ends justifies any means, including attempting to carry out some collusion of your own. Several of the messages show Warner trying to arrange a secret meetup with Christopher Steele, the former spy behind the now infamous Trump dossier.
We want to do this right private in London. Don't want to send letter yet, because if we can't get agreement, we'd rather not have paper trail.
So who was Warner depending on to set up the clandestine meeting with Steele? That would be one Mr. Adam Waldman, a lobbyist best known for acting on behalf of the Russian tycoon Oleg Deripaska. And according to the text, Waldman is also connected to Julian Assange, another person accused of being a Kremlin puppet. Now, this was all way under the table. Warner repeatedly refused to make the invitation to speak to Steele officially in writing, while at the same time telling Waldman that the pair's efforts would be helping America. And apparently, in his mind, the way to do that is to be in cahoots with the confidant of one of the richest men in Russia. And according to Republican Senator Mark Rubio, the whole Senate Intelligence Committee has known about the context for months. So if neither the Democrats nor the Republicans care about Warner's conduct, is it just that collusion is a problem reserved for only one party? Or is the reality here that Russia is just being used in a political game of chess?
And it wasn't just Democrats that were raising the issue and basically comparing the alleged Russian meddling, stated as fact, to an act of war. Dan Coats, who is the Director of National Intelligence, appointed by President Trump himself, voiced a similar claim on Capitol Hill Tuesday.
Frankly, the United States is under attack. Under attack by entities that are using cyber to penetrate virtually every major action that takes place in the United States. From U.S. businesses to the federal government to state and local governments, the United States is threatened by cyber attacks every day.
However, in Coates' view, the threat isn't just coming from Russia, but from a variety of places around the world.
While Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea pose the greatest cyber threats, other nation states, terrorist organizations, transnational criminal organizations, and ever more technically capable groups and individuals use cyber operations to achieve strategic and malign objectives. Some of these actors, including Russia, are likely to pursue even more aggressive cyber attacks with the intent of degrading our democratic values and weakening our alliances. Persistent and disruptive cyber operations will continue against the United States and our European allies, using elections as opportunities to undermine democracy, sow discord, and undermine our values.
It should be noted that in the context of Coates' remarks, a discussion at the Brookings Institution featured a keynote by Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy David Trachtenberg, who explained the latest nuclear posture review of the U.S. government.
Thank you very much. It is my pleasure to be here and to talk about this very critical issue, the nuclear posture review. As you all know, each post-Cold War president has early in his first term conducted a review of U.S. nuclear policy, posture, and programs. President Trump's first national security presidential memorandum, issued 1 week into the new administration, directed Secretary Mattis to undertake the fourth such review of U.S. nuclear policy. The aim of the review was to ensure the United States' nuclear deterrent is modern, robust, flexible, resilient, ready, and appropriately tailored to deter 21st century threats and reassure allies. The Department of Defense conducted this review, along with the Departments of State and Energy, and in consultation with allies and experts from inside and outside the government. The resulting 2018 Nuclear Posture Review establishes the Department of Defense's priority as maintaining a safe and effective nuclear arsenal that can effectively contribute to four key goals: deterring nuclear and non-nuclear attack, assuring allies and partners, achieving U.S. objectives should deterrence fail, and hedging against an uncertain future. The NPR also emphasizes that U.S. nuclear policy will continue to contribute to U.S. nuclear non-proliferation goals. Now, these roles are consistent with past priorities of U.S. nuclear policy. Indeed, the 2018 NPR maintains longstanding nuclear policies adopted by both Democratic and Republican administrations. For example, the new NPR recognizes the need for the nuclear triad and sustains the previous administration's plan for modernizing the aging U.S. nuclear triad of land-based, sea-based, and air-breathing delivery platforms, as well as its supporting nuclear infrastructure and command and control. Consistent with the 2010 NPR, conducted by the prior administration, the 2018 NPR declares that the United States would only consider using nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances to defend U.S. vital interests. In addition, the NPR also reaffirms the U.S. commitment to arms control and nonproliferation by maintaining support for the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and by sustaining the extended deterrent for allies. Extended deterrence is critical to their security and promotes nuclear nonproliferation by checking their need to acquire their own nuclear weapons. Now, each of the previous NPRs has rightly emphasized that U.S. nuclear policy must be responsive to the threat environment of its time. The 2018 NPR addresses the reality that while the Cold War has been over for decades, a much more challenging nuclear threat environment has developed since the previous 2010 nuclear posture review. This is the reality that confronted the new administration when it began its nuclear posture review. Accordingly, the 2018 NPR is grounded in a realistic assessment of the contemporary security environment, one that recognizes a return of great power competition and the increasing salience of nuclear weapons in the arsenals and doctrines of potential adversaries. For example, since 2010, the Russian leadership has made repeated, explicit nuclear threats to U.S. NATO allies and others, brandishing Russian nuclear weapons in a way we really had not seen since the height of the Cold War. Russia is actively modernizing and expanding its strategic and non-strategic nuclear weapons, and doing so in continuing violation of the landmark 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty. Like Russia, China is pursuing expansionist moves at the expense of its neighbors, including key U.S. allies, and doing so also through the threat of force. China also continues to expand its nuclear capabilities in both quantity and quality. Since 2010, China has announced the development of, or fielded, new ICBMs and theater-range ballistic missiles, a new sea-launched ballistic missile, a new ballistic missile submarine, and a new strategic bomber. China's intentional lack of transparency regarding the scope and scale of its nuclear modernization serves only to magnify uncertainties about its future intent. Also, since 2010, North Korea has rapidly increased the pace of its nuclear testing and of theater, intercontinental, and submarine-launched ballistic missiles. At the same time, North Korea has repeatedly made explicit nuclear threats to the United States and our allies in the region. And while Iran's nuclear future remains uncertain, its malign activities and hegemonic aspirations in the Middle East are not. Now, in contrast to these developments over the past decade, the United States has built no new types of nuclear weapons or delivery systems, other than the F-35 for the past 2 decades. We have instead sustained our nuclear deterrent with life extension programs, keeping systems and platforms beyond, decades beyond, their designed service life. Former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter rightly observed that if there is an arms race underway, the United States clearly is not a participant. It is clear that our attempts to lead by example in reducing the numbers and salience of nuclear weapons in the world have not been reciprocated. Since the 2010 NPR, the prospects for great power military confrontation have expanded, while both Russia and China have increased the number and salience of their nuclear weapons programs. The intentional restraint reflected in U.S. nuclear policies did not lead the rest of the world to follow the same path. Now, this is not a unique conclusion reflected in the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review. The U.S. National Intelligence Council recognized this great difference in the U.S. and Russian approaches to nuclear weapons back in 2012, concluding, quote, "Nuclear ambitions in the U.S. and Russia over the last 20 years have evolved in opposite directions. Reducing the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. security strategy is a U.S. objective, while Russia is pursuing new concepts and capabilities for expanding the role of nuclear weapons in its security strategy," end quote. The 2018 NPR responds to this increasingly challenging threat environment not by changing long-standing tenets of U.S. nuclear policy that have bipartisan support, but by emphasizing the maintenance of those capabilities needed to effectively deter war in the current environment. It also seeks to clarify U.S. policies to help remove the potential for mistaken calculation by potential adversaries that limited nuclear first-use threats or escalation can provide them with any possible useful political or military advantage. Correcting the potential for such calculations is now a key to maintaining deterrence of nuclear war. In this regard, I'd like to address three of the corresponding outcomes of the 2018 NPR: the clarification of our nuclear policy and the recommended supplements to U.S. deterrence capabilities, all of which have been subject to considerable news accounts and what I would consider to be considerable mischaracterizations in much of the public commentary. First, let me say the 2018 NPR returns deterrence of nuclear attack against us, our allies and partners, to the top priority of U.S. nuclear policy. Given the security environment and the changes in that environment that I have highlighted, this is a prudent, realistic, and I would argue necessary change. Second, to strengthen deterrence of nuclear and non-nuclear strategic attacks, the 2018 NPR clarifies U.S. declaratory policy regarding nuclear weapons. Doing so does not expand the circumstances for nuclear use or lower the nuclear threshold, as some commentators have suggested. Rather, while maintaining a measure of ambiguity, it provides some clarification regarding what might constitute an extreme circumstance that could lead to U.S. consideration of a possible nuclear response. This clarification enhances deterrence and raises the nuclear threshold by reducing the potential for adversary miscalculation. As potential adversary non-nuclear capabilities continue to become more and more lethal, U.S. policy must make clear that non-nuclear strategic attacks that would have catastrophic effects on the American people and our allies must also be deterred. Finally, in addition to prioritizing deterrence and adding some clarity to extreme circumstances, the 2018 NPR also recommends two nuclear programs to strengthen U.S. capabilities to deter attacks and to assure allies. First is the modification of a small number of existing submarine-launched ballistic missiles to include a low-yield option. Second is the pursuit of a nuclear sea-launched cruise missile. Despite the awesome capabilities of our existing nuclear triad, Russia's actions indicate that Moscow may hold the mistaken belief that its numerous and diverse non-strategic nuclear arsenal provides useful options for limited first-use nuclear threats or employment. We believe the two supplements to the U.S. nuclear arsenal presented in the NPR are important to help correct this misperception and convince Russia and any other potential adversary that the United States and its allies will not be coerced by the threat of limited nuclear first use. Now, the other point I would make is that neither of these capabilities, these two supplemental capabilities, is a new capability. The low yield option for submarine launched ballistic missiles involves a relatively minor modification to an existing warhead. And the sea launched cruise missile is a capability that the United States possessed for decades until recently. In addition, neither of these capabilities will require underground nuclear testing, and both are compliant with all U.S. treaty obligations. These capabilities are intended to strengthen the deterrence of war and the assurance of allies, thereby helping to ensure that nuclear weapons are not employed or proliferated. We must recognize that effective deterrence is about tailoring our capabilities to a potential adversary's calculations regarding the use of nuclear force to ensure that it can never appear to be a useful option. We must assess our capabilities relative to the doctrine, exercises, statements, threats, and behavior of potential adversaries. And the capabilities recommended by the 2018 NPR are tailored to raise the threshold for nuclear use and to do so with minimal changes to the U.S. nuclear posture. We believe the policy announced in the NPR is a reasonable response to the changes in the current security environment. Now, let me be clear. The goal of our recommendations, the goal of the recommendations contained in the 2018 NPR, is to deter war, not to fight one. Modernization of the U.S. nuclear deterrent, adoption of tailored defense strategies with flexible capabilities, and clarification on the role of nuclear weapons all send a strong deterrence message to potential adversaries while also reassuring our allies. Finally, the 2018 NPR helps ensure that our diplomats speak from a position of strength. Russia has little incentive to negotiate seriously about nuclear reductions without a robust and ongoing U.S. nuclear modernization program. Indeed, Russian leaders have said as much. And as Secretary Mattis recently testified, Russia is unlikely to give up something to gain nothing. Critics who favor eliminating U.S. systems in the face of an expansive Russian nuclear modernization effort are undermining America's greatest bargaining leverage and the prospects for future arms agreements. The 2018 Nuclear Posture Review is one of several important reinforcing U.S. national security documents meant to guide U.S. policy in an increasingly complex and challenging world. Much as we might prefer otherwise, U.S. nuclear weapons are the bedrock of American and allied security. As Colin Gray has said, nuclear weapons are a regrettable necessity in the real world. After the slaughter of two world wars, they have prevented large-scale great power conflict for more than seven decades. In an era of renewed great power competition, adversaries, allies, and the American people should know that the United States has the will and the flexible, resilient nuclear forces needed to protect the peace.
With members of both houses of Congress saying that, in effect, an act of war has been committed against the United States by Russia, and with the Pentagon planning for just such a war, it wasn't the danger of war that was being protested by the so-called resistance, but rather military parades. BlackAgendaReport.com's senior editor Bruce Dixon has more.
Word is Donald Trump wants a giant military parade. Artillery, armored vehicles, missile launchers bigger than the North Koreans, and thousands of soldiers, sailors, and Marines marching down Pennsylvania Avenue, possibly with flyovers of his favorite Air Force plane, the mythical F-52 fighter from the Call of Duty video game. Predictably, a chorus of Democrats, along with CNN and MSNBC, panned the idea. Their reasons are all sensible enough. It would cost tens of millions to bring all those troops and hardware to the nation's capital. Furthermore, neither D.C. city streets nor the roads leading to them are designed for armored vehicles, tanks, and their carriers. But most of all, Democrats practically whine, while the U.S. is bombing six or seven countries, while it deploys drones and special forces across vast stretches of Africa and the Middle East, while it has submarines and fleets in all seven seas, with bases, troops, and hardware in over 100 countries, domestic displays of U.S. military might are kind of, well, un-American. If that's not a contradiction, and it's not the only one, the same Democrats who think a military parade on Pennsylvania Avenue is bad form, not 2 months ago voted to give Donald Trump's Pentagon even more than the obscene amount of money he asked for. The same Democrats who wore kente cloth to or boycotted the State of the Union last week because Trump called African and Caribbean nations sh-holes cannot find their voices to object to America's bombing of Yemen, Pakistan, Afghanistan, or Somalia, or the U.S. military provocations against China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, or its blockades of Eritrea and Venezuela. American military flexing, it seems, is perfectly okay, as long as it's done overseas, and preferably, though not necessarily, by a Democrat. Since Vietnam, the last war in which Americans were drafted into the Army, the Pentagon's long-term strategy has been to make the nation's gargantuan military machine and its wars as distant from the public as possible. This explains why there hasn't been a march on Washington since 1968. But Donald Trump doesn't make long-term plans. He seems to want a giant chest-thumping, our missiles are bigger than yours military spectacle to boost his own popularity among the base that elected him. His military parade will do some of that. But it will also draw attention to the fact that America's massive war expenditures are starving schools and libraries, decimating housing and transit infrastructure, are warping what teachers teach and what students learn. At $900 million-plus apiece, every F-35 fighter is worth a small hospital. At $13 billion apiece, an aircraft carrier without the aircraft is worth a dozen bus factories or half a dozen water and sewer systems for a city of 200,000. Unless there's a Republican in the White House, Democrats rarely, if ever, protest against any U.S. wars. Let's see how many Democrats show up to protest Trump's military parade, if he has it. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.